Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning. Welcome to For Your Benefit. My name is Tammy Flanagan, and I'm going to be the host today in place of Bob Lyons, who is down in North Carolina enjoying his nephew's graduation from Wake Forest College. So, hope you're having a good trip, Bob. Maybe you're listening on the way down. This morning, my co-host is Ann Vincent, who's a longtime NITP associate, I guess I could call you, Ann.
Yes, you may.
And welcome, Ann. I'm glad you could be here this morning.
Thank you, Tammy. It's
good
to be here.
On this rainy day, all of us had our struggles getting in this morning.
We sure did.
And Ann has been a frequent co-host on the show, and she's also the marketing strategist for NITP. She's currently semi-retired.
Yes, this is I keep trying.
You keep trying to fully retire, but we keep calling her back. But Ann was the backbone of NITP in the early days of the company during the 1990s when her and I kind of started around the same time.
We did.
In the late 80s, early 90s. So we've been going at it for a long time, along with Pat. I know you go way back with us as well. But Ann, single-handedly, she scheduled the seminars, handled the complicated contracts we had, provided the speakers and all the information we needed to find our way to the seminar site. So we really appreciate all of Ann's work.
Oh, you're welcome. That was before GPS and we had to map everything out.
I know. We had to have good details at those days, right, Pat?
Yes.
And she got us there. She got us there every time. But anyway, so today's show, we're going to have a double header. We've dubbed this the women's show because we've got four of us women here. So far, we've just been introduced to Ann Vincent and myself. And today we're going to be discussing some very important topics that come directly from our three-day pre-retirement seminars. The first topic that I want to introduce is living a long and healthy life in retirement. You know, what good is retirement if you can't enjoy it with good health? And our second topic of the hour will be the important topic of estate planning. There are documents that everybody needs to have, and our second guest will be discussing what those documents are and other issues that are important to preparing for that part of our future. So since we have dubbed this the Women's Show, we plan to just focus on some issues that are unique for women. And I recently did a webinar on women's retirement planning issues and found that at age 85, there are twice as many women in the population as there are men. Does that surprise anybody?
No.
Half of the women who are age 75 and over live alone, which also is, I guess, not a big surprise if you've ever visited a nursing home and you found that there's probably one man for every 20 women there. So that kind of makes sense as well. So the combination of living longer and living alone means that women have to be prepared for a long retirement with a good portion of it on their own and living possibly alone. There are unique retirement planning issues for women, and today we will focus on some healthy ideas with Pat Mann and estate planning issues with Ann Sullivan. So first guest I'll introduce is Dr. Pat Mann. Pat and I are both presenters at NITP Retirement Planning Seminars and have known each other for many years. Won't say how many because I don't really date. 21 years. It's been a lot. Pat's specialty is health promotion, which is maximizing the potential to be healthy and minimizing the potential to develop disease. Pat began her career as a nurse. In fact, she was a MASH unit nurse. I always find that fascinating during the Vietnam War. So I guess I am dating you, Pat. She has also been involved in sports nutrition and weight management for many years. And I am so happy to welcome Pat back to the show as we talk about practical tips for staying healthy and keeping it that way. Welcome, Pat.
Welcome. Thank you, Tammy. Yeah, it's good to be back.
You're welcome. And our second guest today is attorney Ann Sullivan. Ann is also, but she is an associate with the law firm of Handler and Levine that's located here in Bethesda, Maryland, nearby. And the law firm of Handler and Levine specializes in designing estate plans to assure that clients' net worth passes to their intended beneficiaries with minimal tax and administrative expenses, while maximizing flexibility and ease of use for clients during their lives and their families after their deaths. The firm also helps their clients to probate wills, administer estates and trusts, deal with family issues, and minimize the negative impact the passing of a loved one can have on their lives. Also, the firm helps with business formation, planning, and management. Good morning, Ann, and welcome to the show this morning.
Good morning, Tammy. Hi.
Good morning. And I think this is, at least second or third time we've had Ann Sullivan on the show, right?
Second
time?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's start with some basic questions. I guess we'll just kind of have a roundtable discussion here, even though these two topics are not totally related, but we can kind of fit things in and we can all chime in as we go.
Well, Tammy, I have to, Ann and I work together and her colleagues and I have worked together and we always share, you know, part of the day. And I always tell people if they do what I say, they're not going to need an estate planner for
well, there's
forever.
The tie together.
130 years. Of
yes, life. Yes. But there's a lot you can't control out there, so get that taken care of. So
we can use you, Pat, to get us up to that point, and then Anne to take us out the other end. Yeah. Well, Pat, can you give us any top tips on what we can do to stay healthy and live a long, healthy retirement?
Yeah, and I think not only addressing the day by day, but what are our fears down the road? So that's two different things, really. But they do feed into and off of each other. And one of the things I like to start out with every retirement program, anytime I talk to anybody, regardless of their age, is that 70 to 75%, but most people come in about 70 because there are things you can't control, about 70% of the way that we will live, experience our aging after 50 is a function of the way we live our lives. Isn't that amazing?
70%. So say that again, 70%.
70%, whether you're male or female, really, but 70% of the way that you will experience your aging after 50 is a function of the way you live your life.
So not so much our genes, but more so how we behave.
That's where that missing 30% is. According to the National Institute on Aging, 25 to 30% of our health experience is dictated directly from the genes you got from your parents.
And the rest comes from how we live
That's
our
right.
lives.
Hmm. Yeah.
I need to tell that to somebody I was on vacation with last week who said, it doesn't matter, I'm just going to live it up and eat all that butter with my lobster and lay here on the beach and soak up these rays. So some of those things can be harmful and
absolutely
hazardous to our future.
You know how harmful? You know, this is fascinating. This is another point I try to get across to people. If you were to look at our species from the time we first rolled off that assembly line 140,000 years ago up until 1940, up until the Second World War, there were two major threats accounting for our morbidity and mortality. One was infectious disease. And in particular, tuberculosis. I mean, you know, excluding the odd plague, flu, whatever.
Right.
But infectious disease, and the other was trauma.
And what is it from 1940 to now? I hate to know.
It's our behaviors interacting with our genes. And that's the greatest impacts in my field have been made not from exercise science or nutrition, but from genetics.
Wow.
And what the geneticists are able to show us about how our behaviors talk to our genes, and our genes are turning back and talking to our cells, and that's changing our health so much we can't even define it anymore.
So I guess we have to draw a nice balance between our behavior, but yet still living our lives and having fun and feeling fulfilled. So
exactly.
I think there's a balance there that you have to cut.
Absolutely. I always tell people that you can do anything in moderation. There is no room, no need, no value for this obsessive behavior.
And I will tell you, I saw Pat eat a hamburger one time.
I know this is going to be written on my tombstone. There is no life without hot fudge sundaes. I really, really believe that. It's the amount of anything, you know?
But it's just in moderation.
Absolutely.
Okay, with Pat, I think some people who might be listening, I was wondering, like you had said, it's based on sort of what we're doing. But what about people, like if they didn't treat themselves so well, like in their 20s or 30s, can they turn it around? Or is it sort of hopeless?
Reverse the process.
And certainly there are some of us here.
Are you asking, Anne?
Hey, Anne, I was a very
Anne and
healthy
I
are friend.
Looking at each other over that one. Yes. Yeah. You know, that's the most exciting thing of all. You know, truth be told, I started school in 1961. And I've been studying, doing research, working with people, teaching ever since. And what I have come to witness in all the things that I've done, in sickness fields, in health fields, I have come to believe that the body never forgets how to be healthy. It's so incredibly forgiving. And you give it half a chance, it'll find a way to make amends. I've seen people reverse osteoporosis, change their cardiac profiles, their triglyceride, their blood pressure. I've seen type 2 diabetes disappear if people buy in and change their behaviors.
What is the biggest thing for women? Is it osteoporosis, or is it more of the high blood pressure, or is it all related to each other?
Well, that's really important. It depends, again, whether you're talking morbidity or mortality. But the most important thing is to realize you hit on something really important that's not recognized, even within the medical community. The leading cause of death today for women is cardiovascular disease, and it kills more women than it kills men. Mainly because we're not finding what we're not looking for. Women tend to have different signs and symptoms.
Is it affected a lot by our diet and exercise?
Diet, or is stress. It... Mm-hmm. Stress, you can really see the role of stress, because if you look at the rate of change of heart disease in women after the Second World War, it's a J-curve kind of increase. And women went, after the Second World War, women went outside the home to work, but then they came back and did it all too. And engineers will tell you stress isn't a problem because every system has a stress-bearing load. It's when you get into overload. And that's why this idea of I have to do this or I can't.
Well, I think, too, the way we cope with stress, like sometimes we eat too much just to kind of calm ourselves down, or maybe drink too much to calm ourselves down from the stress. So I think that also might have a secondary cause and effect.
It sure does. You're biochemically driven.
So we need to calm down. Yoga.
In response to stress. So again, you're exactly right. Deal with it, you know. And you're driven to want, you're not driven to want calorie sticks. I mean, celery sticks. Have you ever noticed that? Or carrot sticks?
No, that's not what I crave.
Exactly. And that's a biochemical drive. So the only thing you do when you say, no, I can't, is make, you know, make it, the drive increase. Mm-hmm. It's more stress.
I find, too, if you plan ahead, like I've learned, like when I'm trying to control what I eat, I have to think ahead, like, okay, I'm going out tonight, so I don't eat as much for lunch, you know, so you try to think ahead, and that seems to help.
You hit the nail on the head. The keys are deep breathing, yoga, the whole meditative kind of thing.
There's that craze that we're going through is really a worthwhile thing to pursue.
Yeah. A wonderful book on learning how to stop the madness is called Wherever You Go, There You Are.
Wherever You Go, There You Are.
Yeah, it's by a guy named Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he has a number of books. Full catastrophe living.
Yeah, I was going to say, didn't he write a book before that about people who were either diagnosed with, I don't know, terminal illness, or people, or friends of people who were, like, about how to deal with
that circumstance? Yeah, because the whole caretaker syndrome, right?
Right.
It's called full catastrophe living. He has a number of books. But Wherever You Go, There You Are. It's phenomenal. And he's got a two-volume CD out called Mindfulness Meditation. The definition of stress in one word is change. So that's one of the biggest things. When we try to change anything for the better, we always just heap on more stress, because we, instead of drinking a half a glass of water, we drink 8 glasses, you know, and you drown that way. Mm-hmm. Instead of walking 10,000 steps, you know, we start with 10,000 steps instead of 10. You know, gradually changing things.
Well, I live in Northern Virginia. We call it the Northern Virginia Syndrome, where we have not enough balance in our lives because we haven't left anything on the margins. Mm-hmm. You know, we kind of filled our time to the max and we're stressed out.
Yeah, and when people try the whole meditation thing, they think they have to sit there for 30 minutes and go, which they come out of their skin, you know. But that's the beauty of this book. It's about learning to be right here, right now. That's stress management.
Take time out.
And take a deep, just like Granny, you know, take a deep breath.
Yep, there's something to be said.
It changes everything.
Well, if anyone has any questions for Pat Mann or for Ann Sullivan or even for Ann Vincent and myself, feel free to give us a call this morning. We're going to be on the air until right before 11 o'clock. And the number here is 202-465-3080. That's 202-465-3080. And if you'd like to send us an email, we won't get it during this show, but if you'd like to send a follow-up, we'll be happy to answer those. And that email address is...
ForYourBenefit@nitpinc.com.
You spell it out just like the name of the show.
Yes, exactly.
That's fine. Yeah, ForYourBenefit@nitpink.com. And you can reach us, or even if you're listening online, you probably see that link on the website there. So, Ann, why is it that we avoid estate planning? Why don't people want to think about it, do it, especially women? Because we're the ones who are going to be left holding the bag, apparently, according to those statistics.
But I can think of a number of reasons why all of us avoid estate planning. I think the topic alone of just thinking about, you know, people, I always say people have good intentions about it, but then Saturday rolls around and they think, do I really want to spend this Saturday contemplating my own demise or incapacity. And then you think maybe I'm going to have to hire a lawyer and review a bunch of legal documents. And some people out there, and I think a lot of women think, you know, what's estate planning? You know, like, I don't have an estate. I'm not super wealthy. Or, you know, they know they might have to deal with picking guardians for their children. And, all, you know, let's face it, a lot of us have, you know, interesting families, and it's people debate over who should take care of our children. So they just avoid it. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, they think, as I say, they'd rather get a root canal than do their estate, than do their estate planning. And, you know,
Is there a way to break it down, like what you start with? Like, yes. Is there a basic thing to start and then you can build on that?
Absolutely. And one thing I'd say up front is just, you know, for people who say, you know, I don't feel like I have what's an estate? I don't have an estate. I'm not wealthy. You know, even if you're not wealthy, most people have an estate, and it's just, it's everything. You know, it's a house or the furniture in your house or investments or a bank account or what's, you know, in your TSP or 401k, or life insurance. But, you know, most of us have an estate, and we need a plan, and to break it down. So, you know, we talk about estate planning, but what we really mean by that is that everybody needs like a will, a power of attorney, a healthcare directive. And they need to make sure their beneficiary forms for their 401k or life insurance are appropriately, you know, filled out. So right.
Those three documents, a will, a power of attorney, and a healthcare directive. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about what those are? Like, do we need an attorney to form those documents? Is it something you can download off the internet? Can you go to Staples and buy a form?
Yeah. I get asked
what's
that
the best
all the time.
Way to create those, or does it depend on how complicated your situation is?
Well, just to sort of break it down, in terms of the documents, I break them down into sort of lifetime documents that you need and a document after death. And, you know, the one that we're all familiar with is the one that comes into play after we die, which is, you know, a will. But there's actually almost more importantly, or just as important, is that, you know, you need a power of attorney and a healthcare directive. And what those deal with, those are lifetime documents. They have no effect after you pass away. But what they do is it plans for incapacity. So, you know, whether you're in a car accident and you're mentally out of it, or you're, you know, 85, 95 years old and having some issues, this allows you to pick somebody that you trust to manage your finances or to have access for your assets for your benefit. Or in terms of a healthcare directive, it just allows you to appoint someone you trust to communicate with doctors and make decisions for you if you can't communicate with doctors. So it's extremely important. If you don't have, for example, a power of attorney and you don't get that done, people will be surprised by how much of your assets, whether they're jointly owned or separately owned, become frozen upon incapacity. And if that happens and you don't have a power of attorney, someone's going to have to get a guardianship placed over you, which is very expensive. So
So even if you're married, like you have your joint checking account, you have your house in both names, you'd still want to have that document in place.
Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, my husband and I, you know, we've been married for several years, and we would, you know, if he didn't have a power of attorney prepared and something happened to him, and I'd have to go to court, even as an estate planning attorney, even as the person who's been like nagging him for for several years, I'd have to go to court and prove to a judge that I was the right person to serve as his guardian. And 100% of the time, the judge is going to appoint someone to represent my husband mm-hmm. in that proceeding. And even in a case where it's straightforward and there's no argument, like, you know, it's not contested, it costs about $3,000 or $4,000 to do about 3 or 4 months of your time, all of which time your assets are frozen.
Can I say, what you just said shot me. You mean, even if you can prove you're the legal spouse,
yes,
the judge will appoint someone to represent that person?
Yes. And it seems, you know, I know it sounds crazy, but you have to back up and think about it for a second from just the legal system. The court sees it as a huge infringement on your personal liberty to have a guardianship placed over you. You lose, you're treated like a minor again. You can't, you know, somebody's going to make decisions about where you live and take over your finances. And because of that, to be careful, the court always appoints somebody to represent you, you know, the alleged disabled person. But because of that, you're dealing with two attorneys, court time, mm-hmm. and that's not even if it's a contested guardianship. Mm-hmm. I recently I've had some contested guardianships, and the legal fees can go up to, close to $100,000 in those mm-hmm. cases. So,
are these documents that vary from state to state? Like, what if you have a retired person who is going to live part of the year in Maryland and part of the year in Florida? Would they need two separate documents?
That's a good question. For the most part, you can prepare, say, a power of attorney in Maryland, and then if you like to go down to the winter to Florida, other states will respect your home document. But the one exception is if you own real estate in Florida, in Maryland, or in another state, it's always good to check with the local attorney to see if they have a special power of attorney for that land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the healthcare directive. Do they vary from state? And do most hospitals, nursing homes, those type of places accept your healthcare directive?
So the good news about, and by the way, in Maryland, there is a statutory power of attorney now, which is good because it's a start for people. You asked about finding forms online. Mm-hmm. It's not perfect. Attorneys are, in fact, using the statutory one and then creating one in addition to that, but it's a great start. So if you live in Maryland, know that there's a statutory power of attorney. In Virginia, there is not one, but they have sort of in the statute, in the code, statutory provisions for one. Mm-hmm. D.C., they have a very old one, but they have not come up with a new statutory power of attorney. But for the most part, there's a form, not a form, but attorneys come up with their forms for each state for powers of attorney. Healthcare directives, on the other hand, there's a statutory one for each state, but they're different for each state. But again, it's fine if you prepare one for Maryland and then say, go to Florida for half the year. You can bring your Maryland one with you.
And most places would accept it if you didn't have a separate one done.
That's right. They would.
Do you have to carry that with you when you go to Florida?
Well, I know when my cousin
traveled. Well, you know our partner, Norman? Yes. Like, as my mother-in-law, she likes this term, chronic. Like, Norman's chronic about it. Like, he's got his health care directive. He's got one in his glove compartment and on the fridge, and he has one all around. But actually, you can, even if you're not don't live in Maryland, I happen to think that Maryland Attorney General, they have one of the best websites in the country to sort of think about healthcare directives, deal with these issues. And you can go on their website, even if you're not from Maryland, and they have a card that says, I have a healthcare directive, and my healthcare agent is so-and-so, and it gives their number. So that way you just carry it in your wallet.
Yeah, the other thing is, too, my cousin appointed me to help, if something happens, because she's by herself. And so she's given me a copy of all those documents, and I have them at home. And anytime she travels, she's like, don't forget, you've got my documents. If something happens, you call my attorney or call whoever. So at least somebody knows what to do if something happened to her and she's traveling, or if she's at home.
We have ours in a fireproof box, and I always panic. I think, now where's the key to open that thing if I need it real quick?
Yeah, and if somebody had to get into it.
You've got to give somebody the combo or the key. We've run into problems with that before.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is I guess for federal employees, we have beneficiary designations. Those aren't necessarily going to be covered in the will because those are under federal law. So that's different, right?
Well, actually, yeah, it's not. It's just that there's certain assets that are probate that go through a will. And this is where you raise the question about software. This is one area where, people think, I get this all the time. People see Susie Orman's thing, or something, $100 will. And they'll say they'll prepare a will and then they don't go ahead and do it ever, mm-hmm. Because they know in the back of their mind, they're not sure what they're doing. And then some people create a will and they're like, oh, I got this $100 software mm-hmm. package. I did a will. I'm covered, I think.
You really don't know until it's too late.
Right. You don't know. And I know that because I do the probate practice here. But the main big thing is that there's what people don't realize is there's probate property and non-probate property. And a lot of federal employees, I've seen a lot of with my clients, their wealth is in their TSP.
Mm-hmm. And their life insurance. Mm-hmm.
Maybe their lump sum for their pension. And all of that is separate outside of probate property. It does not go by your will. OPM does not care about what you put in your will. They only care about what's on your last recorded beneficiary form. And, you know, while the government has an order of precedence, if you don't fill it out, that's pretty logical, why take a chance? You know, it really needs to be tied in. And I guarantee for a lot of the younger federal employees, they have, you know, they may be married or have a partner and they have minor children. And their beneficiary form sounds, looks something like this. First to my spouse or partner as a primary designee. Mm-hmm. Contingent beneficiary, my children. We have cases come up multiple times a year where a grandparent or a federal employee, like grandparent or parent, puts a grandchild on as, you know, the beneficiary or a child. And Fegley is not going to release funds to a minor child. You have to get a guardianship placed over those funds. So, again, it's an expensive process.
They can delay the payment, too, until OPM figures out who's supposed to get the money.
They'll delay the payment until they can figure it out. Then this happen. Yeah, then what will happen is the child, you have to get a parent, the surviving parent, to be appointed guardian or somebody else over those funds. And then they'll get it out right at 18. So you're, you know, 100,000, 200, you know, whatever you have in your TSP or Fegley.
Go to 18-year-old.
Going to all in one lump sum, you know, to an 18-year-old kid.
What I've been seeing more and more lately is whenever people have a family trust set up, is that something else that might you might want to consider? Because then they'll say on their beneficiary form, payable to the trust of John Smith. And then I guess the trust determines when the children get the money or who's going to split what's left of, you know, the retirement money.
And that's exactly right. I just said, you know, it doesn't matter what you put in your will, but what's important for younger parents is, or, you know, families with younger children or minor children or even young adults, kids under the age of 30, what you can do is you create a family trust or trust in your will where you say where they get, you know, the funds, percentages at a certain time. The trustee can always pay for their college education or schooling or, you know, to help to support them. But at least if, you know, they turn 18 or 21 and they get, you know, part of that money, and if they blow through it, hopefully they'll learn the next time they get a distribution that money goes quick. So it really can save, actually, I find that it could save children from ruining their own lives because at least they can go ahead and they'll get an education.
I've seen that happen, with kids whose parents have passed away or, you know, something's happened like that where they've inherited money too young of an age and they just don't really know how to handle it.
But the key is you need to create a trust, and it's not a separate from your will. It's just a trust within your will that will, for a family trust, where you are designating when children will get money, and you can tie your beneficiary forms into that trust.
Yeah, and the beneficiary forms, there's only four of them, and one is for the Thrift Savings Plan, one is for life insurance, or Fegley, as most federal employees carry. There's one for your retirement for either CSRS or FERS, depending on which system you're covered by, or if you've transferred to FERS, you would use the FERS. And then there's also one a lot of employees forget about, this one called unpaid compensation. So if an employee dies in service, that can be the most important one because that's your last paycheck, your unused annual leave. That's the money that your family might need right away to pay the mortgage, you know, pay the bills that are coming in. And so you want to make sure you have all four of those beneficiary forms kept current because I meet so many employees who fill them out the first day on the job. And I'll meet them at a pre-retirement seminar 30 years later, and they're still not sure if they've ever updated them or if they've ever filed them in the first place. So it's really something I always say, put this on your to-do list today, is update those beneficiary forms if you don't know where they are, if you don't know if you've done them.
And absolutely. And, you know, you cannot divest your current spouse out of your pension, but the other forms and outside the government, too, don't always ask. Some require a spousal waiver, but we have had occasions where not often, thank goodness, but where somebody's former spouse ends up getting the proceeds, like life insurance proceeds. And, you know, it's easy to do. You have a job on day one, you fill out these forms, and 20 years passes. And I just say, like, make sure that some old boyfriend, old girlfriend, or somebody you don't remember their name anymore is the beneficiary of your, you know, your.
What always amazes me, too, when people ask me, they'll say, well, where are my beneficiary forms? And I'm like, well, don't you have the employee copy at home in that fireproof box or in your safety? No, I guess. I didn't save them. Well, then it's time to file new ones.
Right. Absolutely.
Hey, Pat, not to change the subject, but
no,
I was just thinking.
Can I bring up
something? Sure. Yeah, go
because
ahead.
I just had two horrible experiences about this. One in my own life from a relative and another friend. And that is parents who do not designate for care of their children. You know, I mean, even taking a plane ride, I know some people that will make sure that those forms are up to date, but I'm sure that you've had experience too, where for parents and grandparents who are very concerned about this, how can they get people, is there a form? How can they do this simply where they designate who's going to take care of their children.
You mean as a permanent guardian or a temporary guardian?
Either. I mean, or can you do two different things?
You can do two different things. Well, so say you're going on a trip. You can prepare a temporary power of attorney for minors. So that allows like a parent or a grandparent or somebody to take care of your children while you're away. Or let's say you're in a car accident. You can turn these into your daycare provider or school so that a friend, a neighbor can pick up your children. And those will be on record and they can care for them for a few weeks. And then if something happens to you more longer term, they'll transfer custody over to the permanent guardians. But you raise a very good point about guardianship. This is another reason why people avoid estate planning. It's very hard when you're a young couple. People often disagree over who should serve as guardian. Right. And as a result, they just never do their estate planning. They cross their fingers and hope that something happens. Because,
you know, hey, ladies, we have a phone call.
Okay.
Let's find out what our caller is calling about. Good morning.
Good morning, Tammy. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, you're always great. We know that.
Thank you. What's your question for us this morning?
Yeah, I really have a question. First, I have an observation. You know, I had a sister whose husband unexpectedly passed away in New York, and they had not done any kind of trust, etc. And it was such a terrible mess because, finding a reasonable lawyer in New York is just impossible.
Did they have young children?
They had a child, minor child.
Yeah.
And I know it took me, I helped her, and it took a lot of money and a lot of trouble. They'd just done some basic estate planning because in Washington, I knew a couple of good attorneys, but, you know, they won't take anything because case in New York.
Right. So that's a good testimony to say that you do need to do something ahead of time.
Yeah. The second point is I know I've been hearing about the power attorney, and power attorney just essentially is not a very good document because a lot of financial institutions just won't accept it. So I think, trust is a much better way to go.
Well, I understand what you're saying, because my father died and I went to the bank and I had his power of attorney that the attorney had drawn up, and the bank wouldn't take it because they had their own document.
See, they just, I think sometimes it's just a useless piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
You are really presenting some good things, and I hope people, feds like me, take advantage of your advice.
Well, thank you for listening. Thank you so much.
You bet. Bye-bye.
How do you want to respond to that?
Just a couple points. Well, I hear what he's saying about the power of attorney, because that's been a long time frustration about you go to the effort of preparing one and then the banks won't accept it. Or that some banks give you a hard time, and they do.
Or they have their own.
And they have their own. Mm-hmm. Now, that's why the Maryland legislature, if you live in Maryland, has responded by creating this statutory power of attorney.
Are most states doing that?
They're going that way, but not all of them are there. But they're all going in that direction. And the reason they have that in there is because if you turn into the bank the statutory power of attorney, then the bank can pay your attorney's fees if they say they don't accept it. And as a result, the banks have become a lot more friendly in Maryland.
Good. That's good news.
Now, to his point about, and not all states have that, though, and you're right. The bank has their own forms, and your choice is sort of like, do you fill out? What we always say is if you get a power of attorney prepared, make sure to go to the bank in advance and make sure that they accept it. Mm-hmm. Because then you'll know if there's problems in advance and whether they're going to try to make you fill out their own form. And in places like Virginia or D.C., if they do this, then your choices are sort of limited. You either complete theirs as well, which we're not a huge fan of just because they take effect immediately rather than springing to effect upon incapacity, and they don't allow for you to make backup choices as your agent under the power of attorney. That's I'm not saying all banks are like that, but a lot of the forms look like that. So you can either move your money or fill out their form. Now, to the gentleman, the caller's point about trusts, revocable living trusts, that's what he's referring to. A revocable living trust is an alternative to a will. And it's something that you create during your life. You can revoke it. That's why it's called a revocable living trust. And it allows you to appoint, you're your own trustee. And then during your life, if you become incapacitated, you can appoint a successor trustee. And then after your death, you can appoint a trustee to manage your estate. The nice thing about a revocable living trust is that it avoids probate. And it does work a bit more smoothly than a power of attorney in terms of incapacity and having somebody take over your assets. But I will say that sometimes revocable living trusts are a little bit oversold. It just depends on the person. Like, for example, Marylanders and people in D.C., we have a very straightforward probate process. If you're giving your money to close relatives in Maryland, you can elect modified administration. And D.C. has something called unsupervised administration, which is great if there's no family dynamics that are going so wrong.
In a perfect world, it would be good.
But folks from Virginia have a pretty complex probate process, particularly those who live inside the Beltway or, in the closer in counties. As a result, most people from Virginia do have revocable living trusts. And so, but the downside of it is this. If you have a revocable living trust, you have to transfer all of your assets in the name of that trust. Your house, your bank accounts.
And when things change, you have to update it.
You have to always be on top of transferring it in. And I cannot tell you how many times I've seen lawyers prepare revocable living trust documents that the trusts are bare, meaning that the clients have
never transferred assets
nothing
into
was transferred into it. So it's useless.
Back to that power.
And by the way, it's more expensive to have prepared than a will. But yes. Anyway.
Going back to that power of attorney document, we were talking mainly about banks. Is that really mainly where that gets used, is with a bank? Like, what else is a power of attorney used for besides your bank accounts?
It addresses a lot of different issues. It does address your bank accounts, but also any brokerage, investment accounts. You have to fill out a separate form for being able to talk to OPM about TSP, but there's sometimes language in the power of attorney about dealing with beneficiary forms. It can even say changing your will, gifting to charities, selling your property, your real estate.
So it covers more than just handling your day-to-day finances.
Our powers of attorney are now 12 pages long because you really have to specifically say paragraph by paragraph what you want somebody to be able to do, because if you don't, and then they will not have that power. So it's better to be overly inclusive mm-hmm. for a power of attorney.
Right.
Well, this is stressful.
It's not supposed to be stress-free, right? What do we do,
make
Pat?
It stress-free. How do we get rid of the stress?
I'm over here breathing.
I know. Pat's doing her meditative breathing and her deep breathing, yoga breathing. Pat, I was just to kind of get a different subject into the mm-hmm. conversation. It just popped into my head because I did some traveling last week and I spent some time in airports and bathrooms that are public restrooms, even in another country where I was traveling. So I remember one time you were telling me that the biggest thing you do in a bathroom is not so much the paper on the toilet seat, but it's what you do at the sink.
Exactly.
Is that still true?
Yeah. And, it's interesting how there so many of these places now, you don't have to do anything but show up and the water runs, the soap comes out. And what they're finding is that's actually you need human intervention because they're culturing microbes out of those stationary things that don't turn on and off. And it may be the velocity, that.
Well, sometimes the water doesn't stay on long enough.
Exactly. Yeah. So, regardless, it's realizing when you're washing your hands that most microbes are not on the palm side, but on the knuckles. They get embedded in the knuckles and the fingernails and on. And interestingly enough, one of the most important intervening variables is the paper towel. The running water, the friction when you're washing, the paper towel. And so you continue to use that paper towel.
Blow dryer.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. That's a bad idea. And really, if a lot of them, they're trying to correct them, but they're still blowing a lot of dirt off the ground and up in your face. But the key is using that paper towel to open the door, to turn off the spigots, and remembering that 80 to 85% of all microbes are passed from your hands to your eyes.
Wow.
You can have a gazillion bugs. On your hands, but if you don't put your hands to your eyes.
No, you even said one time about underdeveloped countries that if they could just have better running water and ability to wash their hands, mm-hmm. they could cut down on disease by such a large percent.
Yeah.
It just amazes me that we really should, such a little thing to do, it's an easy thing to do, but it can really mm-hmm. cut down on a lot of passing of germs
yes.
back and forth.
Interestingly enough, CDC has released two huge meta-analyses, and they've shown that all this alcohol stuff and the sprays,
the sanitizers,
they haven't made any impact, except to make a lot of people wealthy. But,
sure.
But it's a, granny. I'll go back to granny. Plain old ordinary soap. And we do need to get people getting all this antimicrobial, antibacterial madness out of their lives. It's killing off all the good bugs. It's allowing the other microbes to take this up into their own machinery and become resistant when they never needed to be.
Well, that's why I'm so healthy. I used to play in the dirt when I was a kid.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there is a lot of research. We have kids now that can't fight off certain infections, and we think it's because they never geared up their own immune system.
They never really had a chance to get exposed, because you have to get exposed to it to get the antibodies, I guess, built up. Interesting.
So it's touching your eyes, but I mean, that's like not as important as touching your mouth or your nose or your ears.
Exactly.
Wow. Who knew?
In your own mouth, I mean, you have all these microbes that can fight things off. You have all the acidity and you're continually swallowing. And so washing that away, and then the hydrochloric acid, you know, I mean, your own stomach acids are there to protect you. But and why I try to make a point of that, what do most government federal workers do? They're looking at a screen a foot from their eyes. They never take 20 seconds to relax those tiny, tiny eye muscles. Breeds incredible eye fatigue.
Wow.
And without ever thinking about it, what do babies do when they get tired? They rub their eyes. Mm-hmm. And so you're rubbing your eye with the back of your knuckle or with your fingernail where you've got all these microbes. Mm. So everything you've touched, and the keyboard is one of the most contaminated places of all.
That's where you want to use the sanitizer.
And
the phone.
Yes. Yeah. So it's touching that and putting it to your eyes is the biggest problem.
You know, the other thing I remember you saying, too, is about our diet. And you said the food pyramid has changed, and there's a new website that really gives us a better guideline.
Yes.
Do you remember
what that was? We have Robin did a great job in pulling together. I gave her about 18 pages
for the seminars.
I've pulled out of this that are specific. I encourage everybody to get in and look. It's called Choose My Plate. It is the best. It's choosemyplate.gov. It is the new USDA thing. And they took so long. They were so careful. It was a conglomerate of people coming together, if I can use that word. But and they were over a year late in producing it. And the Center for Nutrition and Public Policy, I never write letters, but when I examined that thing, I had to write them a letter and tell them how invaluable it was.
Choosemyplate.gov.
Choosemyplate.gov. Mm-hmm. And the newest thing that they've come out, the newest edition, and it's on their page, it's called Super Tracker. It is the key to weight control. The most important thing in weight management is keeping records.
I know. I knew you were going to say that.
Not any special diet, there are no bad foods, there are no good foods.
Do you think that's psychological, like knowing that if you're going to write it down, you might not eat it? If I just put down, I ate a Snickers bar, doesn't look good on my journal.
Absolutely. Because, our behaviors today are so rote and so mindless that we're not even thinking about and people do not know what's in their food. Mm-hmm. They just don't know. But this forces you to take a look at that. And I've used it now since the 70s, and it's never failed. It's the most powerful tool. And this super tracker has made me redundant. When you put in it'll spit back all this stuff. When I was teaching at Maryland, all the students used to have to do this by hand, look up all the ingredients, and now it spits it right out. You do learn more if you look it up yourself.
But at least it has all that.
Yeah.
So it's not that hard to do.
No.
You just type in potato, and it'll tell you how many calories, how many protein, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Does it tell you how good coffee is for you?
Yes. Oh. Ann and I were dying because our favorite coffee shop is no longer open.
I know.
Coffee has wonderful, wonderful, wonderful benefits.
The antioxidants in coffee?
Yeah. There is no life without coffee. I've said that from day one, even when we didn't know.
What do you consider moderation for coffee?
Well, that's interesting. That's changed even with American Heart. They used to say 15 ounces. Now, nobody is encouraging that you go this high, but you could get away with 4 6-ounce cups. And that's 6 ounce, not mugs.
Right. The mugs are probably 24 ounces.
Yeah. And what we're really encouraging people to do is to split that up, because the smaller the portion, the more the micronutrients, the polyphenols, all of that sort of stuff that really seem to be good for the brain. for the heart, maybe for the liver, but for the immune system. I mean, there's a lot being looked at right now. But all of that has to get out of the system by 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
So you can sleep.
Yeah, and there's no need for decaf. Yeah. What's interesting is that both coffee and tea will raise your blood sugar and your heart rate for the moment, but not in a sustained way. The soda is documented to contribute to elevated blood pressure, but not the
not coffee or tea.
This is a little separate, but it sort of was leading in with you mentioned stopping coffee at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about women who, so I've heard that older women or women as you get older have sleep issues. Mm-hmm. They wake up in the middle of the night or they have trouble getting to sleep. Why is that?
Women and men.
Yeah, I want to know too.
Oh, okay. Women and men do that, but men are less likely to talk about it unless you really go after it. But and then the other thing is very often it's the man who's snoring, so that's part of why the woman is waking up. But one thing, and a lot of our audience may be of an age where they're either premenopausal or menopausal, all you need to do is increase your body temperature 0.5 degrees, and you will wake up. So the key is that if you wake up, you know, first of all, sleep as cool as you can without being cold, because that heat will wake you up. So that, you know, it's that flush of estrogen that causes the blood vessels to dilate and that sort of thing. So just stand up. That resets everything. Go get a glass of milk or glass of water or something. Throw back the bedclothes. Let the bed cool down. Keep a fan going. But sleep as cool as you can. Something like cotton that wicks the temperature. And, mm-hmm. and if you're perspiring, it's not perspiring that cools you down. It's the evaporation of the sweat. So get into another, you know, just
outfit
change. Yeah, something dry.
And something dry.
Yeah. But but sleep as cool as you can. And you will find at any time that will help you. The other thing is if you're waking up at 2-3 in the morning, that's cortisol. That's a sign you are really stress overloaded.
Really?
You know where your mind is chatter, chatter, chatter?
Mm-hmm. I've heard of a lot of women who do that. Is that why?
If you wake up and we process so much when we're asleep. And if you have not dealt with what's going on during the day, by Jove, you pay me now, you'll pay me later. Mm-hmm. But you will deal with it. And women tend to be the sex that holds it in, that goes over and over and over. And that's what's so great about that book. It's learning to let it go.
Yeah, I think one way to deal with that, and I should do this myself probably, is at night maybe write down the things that you need to do tomorrow or the things that are on your mind, mm-hmm. and just like let it go that way so that you're not going to wake up thinking about it in the middle of the night.
Trying to solve it.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever works, but it's learning to deal with the stress during the day, mm-hmm. because it will come back. But what happens when you're under stress, your body doesn't distinguish real from imagined stress. And almost all of our stressors, in truth, they were real once, but they're done. So they're imagined, but your body can't distinguish that. And what you are telling your primitive body is that there's a fire, somebody's threatening you. Arousal is arousal is arousal.
Your body doesn't know the difference.
Exactly. It's like being in a stoplight. You know, your car doesn't care who's pushing on the gas. It could be a 4-year-old. It could be a brick. And that's fine because the car's designed to go forward. But if you're at a stoplight and you've got one foot on the gas and one on the brake, and that's what we're doing. So your body is churning out all of these mechanisms, getting ready to defend your life, and you don't need that. And that just elevates those levels, and particularly of cortisol. And cortisol will chew up your bones. There is no magic shot, no magic pill that will deal with any of that.
I didn't know that. And what about? And I imagine it can be a vicious cycle in some ways, because if you don't get enough sleep, you know,
yes, indeed,
then it adds on to your stress.
Absolutely, and I mean, our sleeping habits are now recognized to be the number one unrecognized source of psychobiological disorders today.
I've even heard it affects weight management if you don't get enough sleep.
You cannot control your weight if you're not getting sleep. Mm-hmm. And we thought it was a number of different things. And it is. There's no one cause to anything. It's always a number of variables. And for some people, some are more important than others. But when people are tired, they eat for energy. And nothing will buzz you up like a soda.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I was going to ask you about, because my sister-in-law was telling me that she drinks, on average, 1,000 calories of Coke every day.
Oh, whoa.
That's like 4 cans of Coke a day. She just drinks one, finishes it, go gets another one. And what kind of day? And if she switches to Diet Coke, does that help?
No. Outside of illegal drugs and cigarettes, the next worst thing anybody could put into any body would be a soda of any description.
So it doesn't matter if it's Coke product or if it's Sprite or is it any kind
some
of soda?
Some are worse than others, yeah. And certainly the colas appear to be the worst. But you want to get an idea of what the soda is doing, particularly the ones that have the bite. The soda will remove rust. It will remove paint. It will etch marble. It will unstick any. It's better than WD-40. You know.
So cut it out. Huh? Substitute water.
There's no substitute for water unless it's milk, and I'm talking milk, not soy juice, rice juice, almond
cow
juice.
Milk.
Yeah.
But skim milk, not the whole fat.
Well, you know what? I don't even care anymore, Tammy. Our parents ate a ton of fat, and they didn't begin to have the cardiovascular because it's not about any one thing. Sugar is the real killer in our diet today. The processed fat, you know, the partially hydrogenated fats. But certainly skim is the best. But if it takes 1%, it takes 2, it takes whole. Since the middle 70s, we're drinking half as much milk and twice as much soda. And it's no coincidence we've watched our blood pressure, our weight disturbance, our sleep disturbance, our osteoporosis, follow suit.
Wow.
Milk is an integral component in managing all of that.
Boy, we learned a lot from you today, Pat. And Ann, we're down to the last minute. So I was wondering, is there any final thoughts on estate planning or women's issues related to estate planning you wanted to pass on?
I guess the biggest thing is, I think in some form or another, if women can get to the table and do some of it, again, taking the mystery out of it, it's just look at the documents like a will, a power of attorney, healthcare directive, or as this gentleman said, if like you live in Virginia, you'll probably want to explore a revocable living trust. And there's other people who might want that as well. But I find that some people are afraid of it. They think, oh my gosh, if I do that, something's going to happen to me. But it just offers peace of mind when you get it done.
Help you sleep better.
Sleep better. Right, exactly. Right. It doesn't.
Well, thank you all for coming today. Thanks, Ann, for being my co-host.
You
we'll
bet.
See you all next week. Have a good week.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.